You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday. Casual Friday, February 24th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live today in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, indeed. When we recorded this, we were in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. But right now, as you listen to the sound of my voice, undoubtedly, I am begging my child to listen to me. Because that's what I do 90% of the time when I am not working. Because that means that I'm at home with my child, and there's almost a one-to-one relationship between the time that I am with my child and the time that she's not listening to anything I'm telling her to do. I say probably one to 0.98, I guess. 1.97, 0.97, somewhere between 0.97 and 0.99. So yes, probably, I feel comfortable saying 0.98. So 98% of the time she is not listening to me. Supposedly, that's what constitutes vacation. But it is casual Friday, my vacation is winding down. But does that mean that you won't be getting new content? Oh, no, indeed. I doubled up on work last week so that you folks could enjoy yourselves today. But that's a great time to remind you that the only thing, I should say, 98% of this show's support comes from you if you're a member. If you're not a member, 0% comes from you. Or maybe 2%. Maybe you buy Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Or maybe you buy your junk from Amazon through our link at majority.fm and the support the show button. You click it. You click the link. You bookmark the Amazon link. You buy your stuff through Amazon. You never know the difference. But I get basically enough to support this show, or 2% of the support of the show. The other 98% comes from your fellow Majority Report listeners who looked themselves in the mirror and said, time for me to man or woman up and to support a show I listen to and love for just 33 cents a day. And they went to majority.fm. They looked over the different categories of support they could give this show. Maybe they said, I'm going to be a Sam Cedar, and I'm going to give $1,000 a month to the program and get all the benefits of Sam Cedar, which is I can actually host the show, and Sam will spell me for 3 weeks at a time. That is fairly rare that people do that. But maybe they've decided to become a dirty effing hippie. Or maybe they've decided to become a French for $500 a month. Or a professional leftist. Or a super Marxist. Or a Cedarista. Or a Majority Reporter. We have lots of options to support this program, so there's no reason for you not to. Today on the program, we have something you can't hear anywhere else. I'm sure someone must have done an hour-long interview with the author, philosopher, radical environmentalist, if you will, Derek Jensen. But I don't know where that happened. I just don't know. You're not going to see it. There's no media that you have access to right now, at least right this very exact moment, where you could hear that any easier than you could hear it here. Let's put it that way. So if you can afford to become a member, please do. And here is an interview with Derek Jensen. Very interesting interview. You remember he was quoted in that piece by Chris Hedges about the black bloc tactics that are sometimes part of Occupy Wall Street, or I should say there's questions as to whether it should be a part. He's got a lot of things to say about our relationship to the planet and what people are willing to do to protect the planet. So listen, we'll be back on Monday live with guests, maybe. I'm not sure. But I can tell you this. I'm going to be very happy to be away from my vacation at that point, if you get my drift. So enjoy today's show, and we'll see you on Monday. Pleasure to welcome to the program Derek Jensen. His website, derekjensen.org. He is the author of at least a half a dozen books, including The Truths Among Us and Dreams, Deep Green Resistance, Songs of the Dead. He writes for The Orion and The Audubon, Sun Magazine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Derek, I want to talk about a bunch of things with you, but let's start basically with your notion that there's basically an impending collapse scenario out there that we are facing because of the way, well, I guess it's a function of civilization, you'd say. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that's an extremely fair statement.
Give me a sense of what that entails.
Well, we can look at this in a couple ways. One of them is to look at it sort of biologically, and that's every biological indicator is going the wrong direction. You know, fisheries stocks are collapsing. The oceans are collapsing, and part of the problem is that you can't consume a planet and live on it too. And that's a fundamental flaw of this way of perceiving the world. And another way to look at this is that's looking at this ecologically, that a weakened planet can't support you. And another way to look at this is economically, or to look at it in terms of not the planet collapsing, but in terms of this culture collapsing. And that's just pretty straightforward, that any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. And so any way of life that's based on, for example, oil, you know, won't last forever. This is a one-time blowout. And you would really think that if we have the entire economy that's based on the use of oil, we would be having some serious discussions about what to do, you know, as peak oil passes. And another way to look at this is that any way of life that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. And this is where the environmental and the resource usage really sort of comes together, because if fewer salmon return every year than the year before, eventually there won't be any. If fewer passenger pigeons return every year than the year before. At one point, there were six times as many passenger pigeons as all of the birds in North America combined. And they were exterminated. Last major flock was killed in the late 19th century. But up until then, they were really cheap on the streets of New York. And likewise, you know, salmon, where I live in the Pacific Northwest, salmon were so thick that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they would capsize. And there were humans living here for at least 12,500 years, the Talawa Indians. And when the dominant culture arrived here, the place was a paradise. And now, you know, salmon are absolutely hammered. The place is trashed. And we talk all the time about, a lot of people talk all the time about how intelligent humans are, but one reasonable definition of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. But I don't see a lot of intelligence when it comes to this, because I see this pattern of destroying land bases happening again and again. You mentioned civilization, and one of the things I like to talk about with that real briefly is one of the first written myths of the dominant culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq. Prior to the beginning of this culture, Iraq, I mean, what's the first thing you think of when you think of Iraq? It was cedar forest, so thick that sunlight never touched the ground, and they were cut to make cities. The Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. Greece was all the big
dead. Lebanon still has a cedar tree on its flag.
They do. Isn't that wonderful? So this pattern's been going on for a long time, and I wish we would recognize it. You can't consume a planet and live on it. That's the bottom line.
Well, what do you think? I mean, you know, what do you think is prohibiting us to see that pattern? I mean, for instance, like, you know, when we talk about the idea that the Middle East was covered with cedars so thick that you can't see, well, I mean, I can maybe I'm sort of just projecting onto it, but I assume there will be people who say, well, and they're gone now, and look, we're still here. Things change, trees fall, and things continue. What do you say to – what is it that keeps us from seeing that pattern? And what do you say in response to people who say, well, you know, this stuff always works out?
A couple of things. One of them is that there's a great line by Upton Sinclair, and please excuse the sexism, which is, it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And which explains a lot of public discourse in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's also really hard to make someone understand something when their entitlement or their way of life depends on them not understanding it. A great example of that actually is after Fukushima, there was a Japanese minister of energy or something who said that, of course, they have to continue with nuclear energy because, quote, we can't imagine – no, no one – this is a quote – no one can imagine living without electricity, which is pretty interesting because actually almost half the people in the world, half the humans right now in the world do live without electricity. So they can imagine it. It's just that he can't. And actually humans lived very well without electricity. And, you know, I got to tell you, just be honest. I mean, I like hot showers. I got no problem with that. The problem is it's not so important what we want as what is real and what is possible. And so part of the reason we don't see this is because we have entire economic systems that are based on helping us to not see it. And our entire way of looking at the world, it's very interesting that so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And it would have been typical for the people who live where I live now, the Talawa, for them to have conversations with trees. They believe trees have something to say. They believe that salmon have something to say. And of course, if you believe that in the dominant culture, you know, if you believe that as you know, us now, that's just crazy talk to put on radio or TV to say, oh my gosh, a salmon might have something to say. A salmon might actually be a sentient being, or a tree might be a sentient being. But the point is that the Talawa lived here for at least 12,500 years. That way of life worked for living here. And so far as your other question about what do I say to people who say that things have worked so far, well, they've worked for some systems of exploitation generally work kind of well for those who are gaining the benefits from them. It's everybody else who falls apart. There's a really interesting book by this guy, Lundy Bancroft, called Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men. And it's all about abusers. And one of the things he says in there that's very interesting is one of the reasons that abusers so rarely change is because they are addicted to power. And they aren't actually the ones who are suffering. And it's a cliche that addicts generally don't change until they hit bottom. You know, somebody's addicted to heroin or meth or something. You know, I used to teach at a maximum security prison, and a lot of my students had been meth addicts, and they had lost their entire lives. I mean, they'd lost their freedom, they'd lost their families, and they said, you know, if you put the meth here in front of, on the table in front of me, I would take it right away. You know, they had hit bottom, and they were still addicted. And the problem is that if you're addicted to power, it's generally not you who hits bottom, but everybody else. So right now, the salmon are hitting bottom. The oceans are hitting bottom, and one of the reasons that a lot of people don't pay more attention is because their way of life is continuing. And another way to look at this is that you know, you can be driving along and you can send your car off a cliff and you can be falling down off the edge of the cliff, but you know, you're still doing fine until the last foot. And you know, right now we are speeding it, you know, 100 miles an hour towards or off a cliff, and we're still doing fine listening to the radio and having a great time. It's the last foot of the fall that kills you.
All right, well, I want to get back to touch on that notion of being addicted to power and sort of the what can be done when you know, we're all sitting in that car and we're thinking, wow, this is a really nice. We got a great view coming off of this cliff, and you know, because we can't quite see that the ground is getting closer to us, or rather us to the ground. But what do you think about the notion? And one of the, you know, in conversations with people who believe, like, well, yes, okay, maybe we're near or past peak oil, but technology always seems to save us. What do you think about this notion that we will, at least in terms of the resource in our sort of carbon-based economy, that technology is somehow going to rescue us sometime in the near future or the distant future?
A couple things. One of them is that when I finish the book I'm working on right now, I'm going to write a book called Bright Green Lies, which is about – it's going to take all of the technologies that people normally – sort of count on to rescue us and show how each one doesn't work and or has consequences that people generally ignore. And a great example is windmills. You know, people talk about how great windmills are, but one of the things they ignore is the absolute devastation caused by rare earths mining for the windmills. And we forget that technology, like the real world, is all linked, and we think we can have individual pieces of technology without everything that comes with them. And a great example of that would be, once again, windmills. You know, we think, oh, we're going to put solar photovoltaics on our house, and that'll be all great. Well, what we ignore is the effects of the mining that go with it. Plus, also, if you have electricity, that means you have to have wiring. And if you have wiring, that means you have to have mines. And mines are really harmful to that, to the place they take place. And so on one level, we need to just think about these things in context. There's three ways to look at that. That's the first way. Second way is Richard Heinberg wrote this great book called The Party's Over, in which he looked at everything, all of these different alternative energies, in terms of what's called an energy return on investment, which is how much you get out for how much you put in. Like when oil was first discovered, it had this ridiculously high energy return on investment, EROI, of like 100 to 1, which means you only have to put out one calorie to get 100 calories. You scoop it up and burn it. And most of the technologies that they're talking about have very low EROIs, barely over 1, sometimes even under 1, which means that you're putting in more energy than you get out. And that's – I remember when I graduated from Colorado School of Mines, God help me, and it's a very conservative school, very pro-energy school. And I remember my teachers at the time saying, and they're very conservative. And at the time, my teachers were saying that they were all anti-nuclear energy because because of ERLI, because it actually costs more energy to build a thing to mine uranium and everything else than you get out of it. It just makes no sense on the energy level. So that's the second way. And the third way, I'm sorry to get all philosophical on this, but Lewis Mumford has this great term that everybody should know, which is technics, T-E-C-H-N-I-C-S. And what it means is it's the social system that surrounds a piece of technology. It's very simple. He said that there's democratic and authoritarian technics. And a democratic technic is one that anybody can do. It's because a technology doesn't emerge from a vacuum. It comes from and leads to a social system. An authoritarian technic would be one that is not autonomous, but instead requires hierarchical power systems. A very simple example is pottery. Anybody can make pottery. You can make it poorly, but you know, no one can control that as long as I can get mud. On the other hand, solar photovoltaics, I can't make them in my basement. I can't make them, which means I am reliant upon distant corporations, which means that it's inherently, it requires the big social systems with, you know, large government control, large government interference. Another example on a sort of on a weapons level would be the difference between an arrowhead, which anybody can make a bow and arrow, you know, poorly, but you can still make it. On the other hand, if you have a gun, you have to buy the gunpowder and bullets. You cannot make the gunpowder unless, you know, you have access to a bat cave. So the point is that all these technologies are also make us still dependent upon huge corporations. So that's something else that needs to enter this picture. And then the final thing, I guess I said there was going to be three, but there's four. The final thing is I don't want to – every technology that we have ends up creating more unforeseen problems, and it makes me extremely nervous when – people attempt to they bet the life of the planet on a process that has consistently created more problems for the real world than it has solved. You know, is the real world better off because of hydroelectricity? Is the real world better off because of oil? Is the real world, you know, every one of these technological escalations has carried with it severe problems that are never noticed until afterwards when somebody says, oopsie. But it's always the natural world and indigenous people and the poor who end up paying for these. One last example real quick, which is I have Crohn's disease, which is a disease of civilization in that people in non-industrialized areas don't have it. And so I have this disease, and one of the miracle drugs they gave me for it in my 20s was something called prednisone. And it helped tremendously with the disease. Unfortunately, it has this really bad side effect of it kills your bones.
Right.
And so then I had to have this high-tech, you know, cadaver ankle replacement surgery to solve the problem caused by the drug. And I'm on high-tech stuff for the other high-tech stuff for the Crohn's, and who knows what problem that's going to cause. So my point is that every time there's these new miracle technologies, there always is this optimism around them, and people rarely look at the problems, and especially if they continue to centralize power, then of course the problems will be systematically ignored because those in power are making the rules on who gets on what new technologies are put in place.
So, I mean, to expand the Crohn's metaphor, and because I have a friend who has colitis, so I've seen the effects of prednisone over the years. But in that scenario, to use that as a metaphor, the solution from your perspective is one that is one that says we need to change our civilization in such a way that there is no Crohn's. I mean that we need to deal with these issues on such a fundamental level that they. These are a fundamental level that is rarely, I think, discussed as a response, even in what we perceive as mainstream environmental movements, as a response to the problems we're facing.
Yes, I think part of the problem is that a lot of I think the first thing, I don't think we think very clearly about a lot of this. And I think part of the problem is that we don't think clearly and we don't ask ourselves what it is we want. And so you get a lot of mainstream environmentalists who are explicitly saying that what they're attempting to save is civilization. And that's fine, except that it's actually civilization that's killing the planet. And what I would like to hear is for them to say that they're actually trying to save salmon or trying to save the oceans or trying to save the real world. I mean, I'm very clear on what I want, at least, and what I want is I want to live in a world in which there isn't any dioxin in every mother's breast milk. And I want to live in a world in which there isn't 6 to 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in the middle of the oceans. And I want to live in a world with more salmon every year than the year before. And once you say, it's like there's this great guy, Peter Montague, who used to be retired. He used to do the great Rachel's newsletter on toxics. Great, great guy. I love him. And one of the things he talked about is he was saying why carbon sequestration is a bad idea. And he said it's really to pump carbon under the ground. He said that's a really bad idea because if it all leaks out at once, it could, quote, disrupt civilization as we know it, end quote. And I was thinking, no, Peter, it could actually end life on Earth, you know, if it all leaked out at once. It could be absolutely catastrophic. But the point is, there's that loyalty. And so the first thing I would try to suggest is to try to switch our loyalty to the actual real world. And this is really difficult for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is because we grew up in this culture, and so that's we're inculcated into having a loyalty to it from the beginning. Another part, I think about this all the time, is that the system itself has inserted itself between us and the real world, and that's really problematical because we've become dependent. And this is true with any abusive system. I mean, with an abuser, one of the first things they do is they cut off their victim, like a domestic violence situation. They cut off their victim from all the support system. They cut them off from their family. And one of the reasons they do that is to make them dependent on them because that way they can abuse them better. And my point having to do with the culture is that one of the things I say all the time is if your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you're going to defend the system that brings those to you because your life depends on it. If, on the other hand, your food comes from a land base and your water comes from the river, you will defend those to the death because your life depends on it. So part of the problem with us fighting the system is that our lives have been made dependent on it. And yeah, so that's part of our difficulty in even looking at or talking about these issues. But that doesn't alter the fact that the system itself is killing the planet, and
so, well, then what
we
is,
need to switch our loyalty.
Yeah, well, so what is the solution there? I mean, conceptually, that's a very hard thing to get your head around, or at least it is for me in some respects, that the idea that we simply have to – I mean – is the idea that we need to get rid of civilization, that we need to simplify the culture that creates our civilization, or is that even in and of itself sort of contrary to the way that we should be looking at this? We should be looking through that to just the end results of how it's manifested within the natural world.
Well, your questions are all really great. And about this, I want to say that I think a couple things. One of them is that the real planet is dying. And one way to look at this is that if space aliens had come down from outer space and they were systematically vacuuming the oceans and deforesting the planet and changing the climate and putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk, I think we would know what to do. We would destroy the capacity of the space aliens to do this.
Right.
And that's one level. Okay, so I'm going to back up. And I fully believe that, and that's the direction I think we need to go. And at the same time, you know, one of the secrets we don't talk about ever, but is really true, is that capitalism, the free market doesn't really exist on a large scale, and that capitalism is entirely based on subsidies and would collapse immediately without those subsidies. The world's commercial fishing fleets are subsidized to a degree even greater than the catch. So the point is that they're actually paying the commercial fishing fleets more than the value of the catch. So we would all be better off if they were just, you know, to be given the same amount of money and told to stay home in their underpants and watch The Price is Right. You know, so it's just, it's crazy. The whole capitalist system is based on subsidies. So if we were living in a sane and rational and reasonable system, it'd be really simple, because all we do is switch the subsidies away from destructive activities and toward activities that lead to vibrant local communities and vibrant local biological communities and vibrant local economies. You subsidize mom-and-pop stores instead of subsidizing Walmart. You know, it's all pretty straightforward.
Right.
But we don't live in a sane and rational system. And that's part of the next thing, is that years ago I did a talk at one of those environmental festivals where everybody talks about all their great ideas for – all these clever ideas to save energy and make all these little changes. And I found the whole experience really depressing, because – I was the only person there who was talking about either power or sociopathology. And I don't understand how you can talk about social change without talking about power. And I don't understand how you can talk about the murder of the planet without talking about sociopathology. And I mean, it's really clear that, you know, we could have a discussion as to whether Tony Hayward himself personally is a sociopath, but I don't think there's much discussion as to whether BP, the corporation, acts in a sociopathological fashion.
Right.
And when the large corporations are running the whole – I mean, you know, I ask people all over the country, do you believe we live in a democracy? And nobody ever says yes. I mean, a great question about this is, so do you believe that the government takes better care of corporations or human beings? You know, I ask not just people who come to my talk, but I ask normal, everyday people, you know, just people on buses or whatever – I was like, everybody laughs. Of course everybody knows that government takes better care of corporations. And corporations are tools to amass wealth. They're fundamentally sociopathological in their – I mean, they're not beings. They're not actually sociopathological, but they are in how the people within them act. In their system of rewards, they're sociopathological. And we need to talk about that. We need to talk about the fact that how do you stop a sociopath, and how do you – what do you do? Once again, you can't talk about social change without talking about power. And I'm not, when I talk about power there, I'm not specifically talking about violence, although that can be certainly one aspect of it. I just saw this great documentary on the Freedom Riders. It was on PBS. And, you know, all the stuff, like when they got sent to prison, then they decided to flood the prison. And they just kept coming. And they had the numbers to be able to do it. And nonviolence can work if you've got large enough numbers of people. But once again, my point is that once again, that's force. It's like, who's the best environmental president of the last 30 years? It was probably Richard Nixon, which, you know, he was not an environmentalist at all, but he was terrified because of the anti-war protests and because of Watergate. And because of that, he started throwing out all sorts of bones. And so a question becomes politically, how do we make them – they're not going to change because we ask nicely. So how do we make them change?
I want to turn to this notion of leverage and this notion of power in a second. I just want to not to put too fine a point on it, but when the aliens come down in your scenario and they start to suck up the water, or they start to take our resources, you know, and we all we would all react, we've got to fight these people, we've got to stop them, these aliens. The dilemma here seems to be there is this sort of broad understanding, if not explicitly, that corporations are pathological. There is this sort of broad understanding, I think, that government serves moneyed interest, i.e. corporations, more than it does people, that they subsidize the Walmart because Walmart is big enough to have a single lobbyist that's out there that is, you know, can influence these decisions, as opposed to these sort of disparate mom-and-pop stores. But the other problem is that our way of life and our existence is so entwined in that system in a way that, you know, aliens are aliens. And if they die because we kill them because they're, you know, destroying our planet, that doesn't in any way do anything but benefit us. If we were to destroy the system or the civilization as we know it, we would all, I mean, there's this sense, I guess, that we would all be just walking around like, what do we do now?
Well, and some of us wouldn't be walking around. I mean, I have Crohn's disease, and right now I'm reliant upon high-tech medicines for my life. So when I talk about bringing it down, I'm not blithely consigning others to their deaths. I would be dead in 6 months. And that's, and this isn't really noble. It's just true that the health of the land is more important than my own individual life. But I just wanted to say that. But then I also wanted to acknowledge that what you're saying is absolutely true and crucial and central to any discussion of this and is part of the difficulty. And two things about it. One is that part of the problem is that we have been brought up to identify more with the system than with life on Earth and more with the system than with our own bodies. It's like I knew a guy a few years ago whose mother died of an antibiotic-resistant staph infection. And there's a pretty clear correlation between the hyper-use of antibiotics, especially in feedlots, and the emergence of antibiotic-resistant staph infections. And he and I chatted about it a little bit, and you know, I didn't raise this. It was his mother who died,
right.
And I didn't raise the issue politically. That would have been horrible, but I did notice that, you know, the issue somehow came up at some point, and he absolutely wouldn't and couldn't see the connection. And my point in bringing that up is that so often, for so many of us, our identification with the system is stronger even than our love for our own family. You know, if some random person, if some crazy person came into your home and started, you know, poisoning your mother or your sister or your lover or your child or whomever, you know, most of us would respond very strongly. But when it happens systematically, we have this blindness at seeing sort of structural violence. A joke I tell about this is, what do you get if you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. Another one is, what do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. That's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide. At least 8,000 people died there. But, you know, that's more people. That's 2.5 times as many people that died in 9/11. And yet we all know that Osama bin Laden is evil, and we don't perceive Warren Anderson as evil. So that's part of the problem, is that level of blindness. But it takes us back to your original question again, which is a hugely important question, of so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds, which is to separate ourselves from the system. And that doesn't mean that you can't still drive a car, you can't still take a hot shower. What it means is that you recognize that the entire system that brings, you just see that it's true. You know, you see that the entire system that brings them to you is unsustainable and based on exploitation and theft. And then once you see that, then you start making decisions as to how to resist.
And the resistance in this instance is not a function of, I'm going to take 2-minute showers instead of 5-minute showers, or I'm going to unplug my power strip at the end of the day, or I'm definitely going to start recycling, you know, Monday without meat, whatever, meatless Mondays. Let's talk about that. Like, how do we, if you know, it seems to me that if you were to get that level of awareness, that you were conscious of each action and what the implications were for the future of the planet by engaging in those actions, and what the implications of that were in the aggregate of everyone engaging in those, it seems to me that one or two things would happen. Is one, that you just learn to live with it, or two, that it would just be overwhelming.
Well, the important thing to remember about taking shorter showers, for example, is that more than 90% of water used by human beings is actually used for agriculture and industry. So if we personally take shorter showers, that's actually pretty trivial in terms of actual water use.
I mean, I think all personal sort of like changes in habit are seem to be quite sort of ineffective. I mean, what we need fundamentally is a either a, like a policy change or a broader change, I guess, in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's like a friend of mine says that the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to dismantle those systems of oppressive authority. So the personal change level, I think, is a – I mean, I live pretty cheaply myself, but that's mainly because I'm a cheapskate. It's not a political act. And so it's not – I mean, that's not so much the direction. The direction really is organized political resistance. And the way you – it's like I said earlier about those in power understand force. Which, once again, I'm not specifically meaning violence with that. You know, Gene Sharp has written so much about nonviolent force, too. But what this means is we need to organize. You know, it's a classic thing with unions, when unions work right, that, you know, one worker individually bargaining has no power, but collectively they do. And so we need to organize, and we need to I feel like I'm missing your question here with this one, though. Am I missing your question?
Well, no. I mean, I think the point being is I'm just I'm looking for – I mean, a call for organization. But, I mean, this is – there's a greater challenge here than the organization that we see in the context of unions because, you know, the theory is that everybody organizes to increase our bargaining power in the context of the system. It's going to benefit everyone. When you are talking about – organizing to essentially deconstruct the civilization, you yourself, you know, end up not, I guess, a winner in that respect. I mean, I understand the perception that you are winning because for what you want, it is the survival of the planet. I guess the challenge is like, you know, do we need everyone to have that perspective before they start to exercise some sort of political leverage to get changes towards that end?
You know, I have to say that your questions are some of the best I've ever gotten. These are great.
Oh. We will definitely leave that in.
yeah, cut everything else, leave that in. So the point is that I think we do have models for this, and one model would be the at least white portions of the abolition movement, and also the freed black parts of the abolition movement, because they already had their freedom. We do have movements where people have attempted to not merely better their own lot, but to assist others. I would say that the Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War was an example. I would say those who were not directly affected by apartheid still participating in the apartheid struggle. I would say the people who participate in Palestinian solidarity. So we do have examples for that. I would say a lot of animal liberation people, you know, who are acting, or earth liberation people, or actually environmentalists in general, especially non-mainstream environmentalists, but more of the grassroots activists. You know, I remember years ago, probably, gosh, 20 years ago now, I was in a meeting with a whole bunch of environmentalists starting a campaign. And I said, before we start, I got a question. Why are we doing this? What's the purpose? And we each went around the room saying why we were participating in this campaign. And this one woman's answer really encapsulated sort of everybody's answer, for me at least, which was she just said, for the critters. And, you know, part of it is doing it for love. You know, there's got to be someone you love, and who do you and probably there's a good chance that who or what you love is under attack, and we act to defend it. You know, it's I think about this a lot. You know, I've been talking about identity, and you know, part of what happens with one of the ways that those in power get us to one of the ways that those in power get a lot of people to join the military is by saying we are attacked, you're defending us, and it's that identity. And let's talk about I mean, once again, switching that identity to the trees right here, or you know, there's a developer tried to come in and destroy part of the forest where I live in this particular neighborhood, and it was pretty great because everybody in the neighborhood came together to try to stop this guy, and it was so funny. There was one conversation once where this one person who's part of our neighborhood group stopping the guy said, "So you're just stopping this because you don't want this in the neighborhood, right? You're not one of those environmentalists or anything, are you?" I'm like, "Those are really good cookies. Can we, I'll have a cookie, please." And the point is that if you look at this in terms of fighting for the health of your, you know, do you have one child or more than one child?
I have one child.
Okay, so, and you don't have to answer if you don't want, but I mean, are you concerned for your child's future in terms of? Okay, so that is something worth fighting for too. But see, that becomes really difficult too, because like, if I succeed, you know, your kid's not going to have access to electricity. But if I don't succeed, your kid might not have electricity or might not have access to water. You know, it's like.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, this is that dilemma is the notion of, you know, if I make $1 million, you know, or $500 million, I can send her, you know, I can put her in this sort of big, huge bubble, you know, that we can build. And I can at least delude myself that the chances of her survival in that scenario are as high as her chances of survival in an alternative scenario, where we don't need to put her in that plastic bubble.
Right.
And so this is fascinating, but we don't have too much time left, and if you can stay, that would be great. But I want to just turn to bring it down to a little bit more practical in terms of Occupy Wall Street and in terms of how you see this movement having the potential to bring about the leverage. I mean, because, you know, I read your quote in Christopher Hedges' piece about his feelings about the black bloc tactics being used in some parts of Occupy Wall Street movement. And I've read other things and seen other things that you've said. And it seems to me that you have a very specific notion of power and the type of power that's being used, and it being very much a function of the leverage that one has using a specific type of power. And I'd like you to just talk about how you see maybe Occupy Wall Street could leverage these type of things, or what needs to happen in the context of moving towards these goals.
Well, I think that one reason that Occupy Wall Street has, or Occupy Everywhere, has succeeded as well as it has, insofar as it succeeded, because I'm not sure if it succeeded because I'm not sure what their goals were, which is a longer conversation. But insofar as Occupy Wall Street has succeeded, I think a lot of, here I can say this, that I think one of the reasons Occupy Wall Street has grown and has caught on so much is that it is manifesting something that so many of us feel, which is that the government serves the 1% and is completely out of touch with what real people need, and is in fact quite often actually in opposition to what real people want, you know, serving the corporations over the people again and again. And that's so, you know, despite whatever flaws there are of Occupy, that's one reason it took off, because it was manifesting something that has been absent, you know, which is outrage on the left. You know, my mom has been saying for years, one of her favorite things to say is, "Where is the outrage?" And I think that has been a lot of it. And I think one of the – I got a note from somebody who – is one of the founders, maybe. He's one of the people who runs the Occupied Wall Street Journal. And he asked me to, he said basically he thinks that one of the weaknesses of the Occupy movement is it didn't have enough environmental sensibility, and also that we entered into a discussion of actually making demands. And so one of the things I did is I came up with a whole list of environmental demands, and so backing up a second, I think I go back to the question I asked earlier, which is I think we need to ask ourselves what we want. And I think Occupy has been really good at manifesting a lot of the upset that people have, and I don't think it's necessarily been so good at manifesting really what they want. I remember one of the demands that came out of Occupy Wall Street itself was a demand for full employment, and I honestly cringed a little bit when I read that, because within capitalism, structurally and functionally, you can't have full employment. You know, right. That's fine to make the demand, but I wish they would have put it in the context of, you know, making a demand that we all know that can't be met, so that we can then expose the contradictions of the system. But I'm not sure it was being made on that level. And another concern that I had, and I've expressed this, I spoke at several Occupies, and another thing I said is that demanding a bigger piece of the pie on a world being murdered is a wee bit insufficient. But that has to do with just, I think we need to add that. But having said all that, I think it's a good recruiting tool. And now I would like to see Occupy move to the next stage of development, to begin to figure out, to have these discussions of what do we want and how are we going to go about getting it.
And speaking specifically about the notion of the of Occupy, sort of, I guess, the at least in New York, supposedly sort of written into sort of, or at least one of the principles was this notion of diversity of tactics. And there's, you know, like I mentioned, and obviously you're aware of, there's been, you know, some controversy within from different voices from the movement talking about the use of block tactics and how much those in the movement should hold those who use those tactics accountable. Give me your sense of where do you fall in that conversation?
Well, I am a huge believer in a diversity of tactics, and I believe, I say all the time, that we need it all. And having said that, I think it's really important, if you do believe in a diversity of tactics, to separate nonviolent resistance from more militant resistance for any number of reasons. And so I think that I've been misinterpreted quite a lot on what I wrote, or what I said to Chris Hedges has been, I think, willfully misinterpreted, in that I said explicitly that I said, you know, if you pick up a rock, if you pick up a sign, if you pick up a gun, that you need to do so thoughtfully. And a lot of people have been basically calling me a pacifist, and, you know, there's nothing could be further from the truth. I just think that one needs to think clearly about what one is going to do, whether you're going to pick up a sign, a gun, or a rock, or it doesn't matter. I think we need to choose targets carefully. I think one of the reasons that a lot of people are somewhat enamored of the Black Bloc is that we are so hungry for some sort of militant resistance that a lot of us will accept anything that comes by. And I think that that's not, I don't think that escalation for the sake of escalation is necessarily a good idea. I think that one should choose one's targets carefully. And one example of that is one of the things that happened in Occupy is they looted a local coffee shop that had been giving coffee free to members of Occupy and letting them use the bathroom. And I don't see any way that that was an intelligent target to pick. And I think that's actually a harmful target to pick. And once again, me saying that has been misconstrued as saying that I don't believe that escalation is ever appropriate. And that's also, it's also, I have to say that both Chris and I have received veiled and or open death threats from black bloc types since then. And a lot of the crap that has been said about me is really vile. And one of the things that does for me is lets me know that there are people who have a lot of rage who don't know how to channel it, because I don't see this same rage being sent against Massey Cole. You know, it's like, why are you attacking me or Chris as opposed to Tony Hayward? It's just, it's extraordinary the level of vituperation that has happened as a fallout of that.
You know, it's interesting because I interpreted your quotes in Hedges' piece as essentially saying the effect of I'm for diversity of tactics, but this is not tactical. that there is no that, I mean, I think to a certain extent the idea of simply throwing a rock through a supporter's coffee shop could be argued to not even be a tactic at that point. It simply is a gesture that has no tactical resonance whatsoever. I don't know if that's a fair assessment, but just to clarify though, that you don't consider yourself a pacifist. I mean, but you also, you think that there, I mean, give me your sense of, do you think that it's even possible? Are we not living, isn't there an argument that the system that we're living in is in and of itself already violent?
Oh, completely. Yeah. It's based on structural violence, and I mean, it's based on violence against women. It's based on violence against the natural world. It's based on violence against indigenous people who continue to have their land stolen. I mean, it's completely based. It's based on violence against people of color. You know, there are between, let's see, more than about a third of all African American males in the ages of 18 and 35 are under so-called criminal justice supervision, and that's a segregation on a scale the KKK can only dream of. That's the United States. In some communities like Baltimore, more than 50% of the African-American males in the ages of 18 and 35 are under criminal justice supervision. And, yeah, so it's extremely violent. And the system is based on this violence that quite often most of us don't notice, because we are not the recipients of it, and we're, in fact, the beneficiaries of it. You know, we get the Apple products as the people are worked to death in the factories. So yeah, it's completely based on violence. That's one of the reasons that I'm not a pacifist, is that I see this around, and I don't see when people are the economic beneficiaries or the tangible beneficiaries of a system of structural violence. I don't see that there's much way to dislodge them through discourse.
And so after the sort of coming to grips, Occupy Wall Street, with a sort of a clearer sense of what they want, I mean, what do you see from a tactical standpoint? What do you think you'd like to see, or what do you think would be effective next tactical steps?
What I would like to see would be, instead of attempting to hold ground for pretty much symbolic purposes, I would love to see people beginning to blockade, to have actions that are moving beyond the strictly symbolic, by which I mean to have actions that actually blockade or that impinge upon the actual workings of the economic machine. And a great example of that would be the French strikes of, 14 months ago, where in addition to doing, you know, regular strikes and marches and everything else, they recognized that the system is based on oil, and they blockaded the oil terminals. And then when the French decided to open up their strategic reserves, the French government, the people moved to blockade those places too. And so the next step in the escalation of Occupy that I would love to see would be one where they begin to think like members of a resistance and how do we shut this thing down and start looking at how do we blockade oil terminals? How do we blockade, how do we make sure that, and once again, I believe in a diversity of tactics. I think we should use means within the system to stop Keystone XL, for example, you know, whatever project is really horrid. There's that's one of the great things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's really great work to be done. So you find this project that's just horrid and atrocious and is destroying some place you love, and you can certainly try to use all sorts of, you can try lobbying, you can try all those things. I have no problem with somebody trying that, but in addition, I think we can start thinking strategically about how do we use our bodies to actually shut it down. So instead of occupying, or in addition to occupying Zuccotti Park, also, what are you going to do about fracking? Where are you going to occupy for that? Where are you going to actually shut down the machinery?
Interesting. Well, Derek Jensen, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate your taking the time. It's fascinating stuff. A language older than words, the culture of make-believe, Endgame, among some of the books you have written. And, of course, people can head over to derekjensen.org. We'll put a link up on majority.fm. Thanks so much for taking the time and talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Your questions are great, and I'd love to do it again.
Oh,